Please feel free to sit comfortably. This is not really Zazen now, so please sit comfortably. First, I'd like to apologize for not being here earlier for the Zazen. I had a chance to meet a friend that I hadn't seen for some time, so as much as we should have been doing Zazen, I was in the kitchen talking. My apologies. I would like to talk today about the source of Zen. I know some of you are experienced. Can you hear okay?
Higher?
Like, I can stand. I don't levitate yet, sorry. I'll try to speak up though. How are you? Good to see you again. If you can't hear, just let me know. Oh, Peter, hello. So I would like to speak today on the source of Zen. I know some of you are experienced sitters and some are maybe complete beginners. So one of the challenges for me tonight is to be able to make it worthwhile for someone who is experienced, but also understandable for someone who has no background. So I will do my best. There's one Chinese or Japanese character which is written very simply. I don't have a blackboard, so I'll simply write it in the air. But it's like that, four strokes, one, two, three, four. It's pronounced shin or kokudo in Japanese, translated as heart or mind or sometimes soul or true self. And if you can just remember that one character, heart, mind, self, it means all of those things and a lot more. If you can just remember that, then you've got the lecture. Don't worry about all the different names and places and 1,200 years ago and whatnot. To speak about the source of Zen, one way is to talk about it in terms of transmission or lineage. In other words, about 2,500 years ago, there was a man, we call him Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha in India. And supposedly he gained a great awakening, religious insight, sitting under the Bodhi tree. And then it's said, especially in the Zen tradition, Zen is one school of Buddhism, that he transmitted, that he handed down that Dharma. Dharma means the Buddhist truth, the actualized living truth. Shakyamuni handed down or transmitted that truth to someone named Mahakashapa. It doesn't matter the name. And then someone else, and then someone else. And it has continued up until today. Okay? So that's the basic meaning. It is a lineage over generations. It's also a transmission, and I want to try to unpack what that means. What does it mean to transmit the heart, transmit the mind, transmit religious truth? Okay? Now let me read a couple of standard statements about what transmission and lineage is. So if you don't have any background, you can get some idea. Okay, to quote from a book on Zen. The experience of Kensho, Kensho means awakening, religious enlightenment. The experience of Kensho has been handed down directly from Shakyamuni Buddha through successive generations of patriarchs to men of the present by means of the transmission of mind by mind. This is another important term. If you're interested, you might want to remember. Transmission of mind by mind. That character is used twice. transmission of mind by mind. The mind is transmitting the mind. Okay? To continue the quote. As long as the direct experience of Kensho, awakening, enlightenment, continues to be thus transmitted from generation to generation, Zen will not disappear. Okay? So, I think kind of like what I was talking about. Another quote to give you a sense. The phrase mind-to-mind transmission states the pivot, the core, of the Zen teaching method, a method which demands that the teacher have a student as much as that the student have a teacher. At the moment the disciple's mind reaches the same state of intuitive understanding as that of the master, a fusion, oneness, a fusion of minds takes place, and the understanding of the disciple becomes one with that of the master. Or, in the traditional words, the master transmits his mind to the disciple. No words are employed in this transmission, which in Zen is considered the only method by which the ultimate truth of Buddhism can be correctly handed down from generation to generation. Okay, so that's a general overview of what the mind and mind-to-mind transmission and lineage over the generations. This is a very important spiritual lineage. As I just said, without it, there is no Zen. There are some more interesting expressions about it, too. For example, they say, it's like pouring water from one vessel, from one container, into another exactly like it. So unless the disciple, the student's mind, is identical with the master's, the water cannot smoothly go from one container to the other. Another more powerful expression says, anyone of our sect, that is the Zen sect, who does not create even a single Dharma heir, that is a successor for the lineage, in his lifetime will surely fall into hell at death. This is not literally true, but you can see that it's pretty important if they say you're going to go to hell if you don't do it. So you have to create at least one disciple who can carry on this transmission. In a sense, it seems even more important than life. Another very interesting expression, I think, and I'll return to it later, is this one. Insight equaling the master's diminishes the master's by half. Only insight surpassing the master's is worthy of receiving the transmission. Interesting expression. If you understand, a little different from the container, right? The container metaphor, which said one container to the other exactly like it. Here, it's even more radical, and it says unless the next generation, it's even better, it won't really be transmitted. This is something about Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma was considered the 28th generation from Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha. Bodhidharma is also the Indian Buddhist monk who brought, he didn't really bring anything, but they say he brought Zen to China. He introduced Zen to China. He is the 28th Indian patriarch and also the first Chinese patriarch. He said this, the three worlds are the worlds of desire, form, and formlessness, but you can just think of it as the whole world, the whole universe. All things arise from and all return to the one mind, the same character. From Buddha to Buddha, mind is transmitted by mind. The same expression, mind is transmitted by mind. But again, if you look, this is very important. The first patriarch of Zen, he's saying both all comes from and returns to the one mind, and yet this mind is transmitted. and it's transmitted by mind. A very strange expression. I think we'll need to return to that later to see what he really means. Another example of this transmission of mind is the sixth patriarch. So five generations later in China, the sixth patriarch of Chinese Zen, actually he didn't say it, but the fifth patriarch said this when the Dharma was transmitted to the sixth patriarch. Supposedly the fifth patriarch said to the sixth patriarch, Dharma, the Buddhist truth, is transmitted by mind with mind. The same expression. This Dharma must be realized by oneself. So he's saying there must be a transmission of mind by mind, and then in the very next sentence, actually in Chinese it's the same sentence, he says, and you must realize it yourself. This is strange, isn't it? There has to be a transmission of what? Something that you have to realize yourself. This is rather ambiguous, isn't it? I think the obvious point is we need to go a little deeper to understand what the heck this really means. But first, let me just summarize to make sure you follow me up to here. This is the general basic understanding of the Dharma, the Buddhist truth, and of transmission of mind by mind. It's nonverbal, right? We already heard it doesn't rely on words. It's some kind of a direct identifying. It's transmitted without interruption from generation to generation since Shakyamuni 2,500 years ago up till today. But also, it's spoken of as if it is to kind of acknowledge or confirm or verify or authenticate the student's religious awakening through a face-to-face encounter with his master. So it's almost as if both of these meanings are contained here. And the Chinese are, in the Western sense, not very logical in saying which one they're talking about. Usually I think they're talking about both. The Zen sect is often called the school of the Buddha mind, the same character. The Buddha means the awakened one, the awakened mind. So the Zen sect, another name for it, is the Buddha mind sect. One reason is that some of the other Buddhist schools rely on a specific sutra or text. In other words, when someone asks, what is the basis for you saying that? How do you know that that is the ultimate Buddhist truth? They can say, it's right here, page 27 of the Lotus Sutra. See, it says this. That's the basis of my faith. Zen does not do that. Zen says you have to go to your own mind and realize it there. Then you can see it in the sutras. You don't get it from the sutras. You get it somehow from your own kokoro, mind or heart. And yet, it's transmitted. Right? So please, keep these two senses in mind. We have to work this out, right? One of the problems, of course, is if we take it too literally, it sounds almost like some kind of psychic ESP, you know, I've got the Dharma transmission. It doesn't mean that at all, of course. This is not ESP or something like that. It is a religious awakening, a religious transmission in, I think, the deepest sense. But sometimes when you read the writings of Zen masters, it does sound as if there's some kind of psychic phenomena. And Zen Buddhism, not just now in Europe, but long ago in China, has run the danger of turning into a kind of religious cult. Cult in the bad sense of the term. It becomes an esoteric, secret, hidden teaching that someone gives to someone else who has fulfilled certain obligations, undergone certain practice, and it's not shared with the rest of the world. This is, strangely enough, a constant problem for Zen Buddhism. And I'll give some examples later on, not just now, but 1200 years ago in the Tang Dynasty. It may sound very strange to some of you who have read about Zen. It's completely open, all beings have the Buddha nature, everyone can awaken. Well, then what's all this almost esoteric transmission only to one person? Very strange, isn't it? Okay, so don't let me leave tonight without making clear how this is possible. Huh? So first, let's go one step deeper to an understanding of what this mind-to-mind transmission really means. One expression I'd like to mention is what they call literally transmitting the untransmittable. What does it mean to have a transmission in Zen, to hand something down to your student? It means to transmit the untransmittable, to transmit what cannot be transmitted. So here we're face to face with the contradiction that we faced earlier. What a strange expression. They don't say transmit the wonderful Dharma, the wonderful Buddhist truth. They say transmit the untransmittable, literally. Fuden no den in Japanese. Simply fuden, not transmittable, no den. The transmission of the not transmittable. There are many examples of this expression. So we need to ask, what could it possibly mean to transmit the Dharma, to transmit the truth, to transmit the heart? How do you transmit that? To give one very simple example, this is from case 7 of the Blue Cliff Record. That's a koan collection, but don't worry about it. In case 7, the question is, to pronounce in Japanese, Echo, a Zen monk, went to his master, and Echo said, "Master, what is the Buddha?" Which is the ultimate question, right? What is the awakened one? Echo asks, "What is Buddha?" The master answers, "You are, Echo." That, in a sense, is the simplest mondo, or exchange, in Zen Buddhism. You may have heard other more complicated ones. What is the Buddha? 3 pounds of flax. What is the Buddha? A piece of shit. There's even such a koan. But here it's even simpler. Echo, the monk named Echo, asks, "What is the Buddha?" And the master says, "You are Echo." So it's like saying, Jan asks, "What is Buddha?" And the master says, "You are Jan." It's as simple as that. It's like a first grade English grammar text, isn't it? Except for the word Buddha, maybe. Would someone tell me how you can transmit that? What is the Buddha? You are. Why are you asking me? Is this a transmission or not? Is something being transmitted, religious or otherwise, or not? I don't want to give away the answer because then you might not stay till the end of the lecture, so let me do some more stuff. It might be helpful to look at Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, how he is viewed in the Zen tradition, and it might give us some insight here. Another koan collection called the Mumong Khan, or Gateless Barrier, case 6, it gives this very famous koan. It says, Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, was to give a lecture before a great audience. And he came up, he had been given a flower. And when he stood up in front of the audience, who was waiting, expecting the enlightening words of the Buddha, he simply raised a flower. He didn't say a word. He simply went. Everyone in the audience said, maybe thought something like, "Nice flower. Now let's hear the enlightening words." They were waiting. They were anticipating something. from the master, maybe a transmission of sorts. One person in the audience did not. His name was Mahakashyapa. He's the one that received the transmission. What did he do? He, according to the story, it's legend, it's not history. No such text exists in India. Only in China do we find an extant text of this. It was probably created in China. But according to the legend, so again, it's not history, but very interesting legend, I think. He smiled. I'll see you later. My wife and my son have heard this before, so they're... So again, all the audience is waiting, but one guy in there, Mahakashyapa, he just spontaneously smiled because he heard, if I may say that, he heard the wonderful sermon of holding up the flower. And then, according to the legend, it's rather complicated, but Shakyamuni says, I have the formless Dharma truth, and I now transmit it to you, Mahakashyapa. Very strange story, but a very important one, because this is the beginning, legendary, of the Zen tradition, from Shakyamuni to the next patriarch. I'd like to read a little bit of what Mumon Ekkai, pronounced in Japanese, the author of the Zen collection, the Mumon Kan, what he says. He quotes this koan, and then he says the following. Yellow-faced Gautama, Shakyamuni, is certainly outrageous. Yellow-faced, he was Indian, so they speak that way. It sounds like a derogatory term, but actually he's playing with words. He means it in an honorific sense, but often Zen people sound like they're criticizing. It's a way of praise. You'll see this again and again. He, Shakyamuni, turns the noble into the lowly, sells dog flesh advertised as sheep's head. It's a Chinese expression. He advertises something very beautiful, the Dharma, but he just sells a dog's head. I thought there was something interesting in it. However, at that time, when the Dharma was transmitted, if everyone in the assembly had smiled, to whom would the true Dharma have been transmitted? We got a problem, don't we? If everybody smiles, or again, if Mahakashyapa had not smiled, would the true Dharma have been transmitted? What if he didn't smile? We'd have no Buddhism? To continue, Master Mumon, if you say that the true Dharma can be transmitted, the yellow-faced old man with his loud voice deceived simple villagers. He's a mere trickster, a huckster. Why? All beings have the Buddha nature, don't they? Why did he have to give just one person the transmission? Don't we all have it? Again, he continues to play with the reader. If you say that it cannot be transmitted, then why was Mahakashyapa alone approved? We're back at the start, aren't we? If you simply say, oh, everybody has it, that won't do, because only one was approved. But what if he didn't smile? It's really no problem, but he makes it sound like one, because he's challenging us to realize what this transmission is. Where is it coming from? Did it come from Shakyamuni to Mahakashyapa? Where did the transmission come from? Let me mention a mature Zen master in the late Tang Dynasty, so we're talking about a little over 1,000 years ago, what he said commenting on the birth of Shakyamuni, okay? So now we're going to get radical, so you better put your seatbelts on, okay? Because this is how a Zen master responds to this, okay? The Zen master's name in Japanese is Ummon, in Japanese, Yumnem. He relates the story to his audience, to his monks, of how when Shakyamuni was born, the kind of like the virgin birth. It says that he simply came out of the side of his mother, just born, and then he took 7 steps. A newborn baby cannot do this. Okay, this is religious myth, okay? Took 7 steps, one hand up, one hand down, and he said, heaven above, heaven below, I alone am the most honored one. And it says he walked around in a circle. Newborn baby. Pretty heavy stuff for a newborn baby. Early child education. Heaven above, heaven below, I alone am the most honored one. It's interesting, in Japan today, that expression is still used. And it means someone who doesn't listen to anybody else. It's a negative term. Heaven above, heaven below, I alone am the most honored one. I don't need to listen to you. But it doesn't mean that at all. That's not the original meaning. The original meaning is, having realized himself, he is all things. So when he says, I alone am the most honored one, he means I in concert with the entire universe. That's the most honored thing. It's a religious statement. It's not a selfish statement at all. Of course, Ummon knows that. The Zen master who is now going to comment knows the meaning. But he asks his audience, what about this? What about this, Shakyamuni, being born and saying these profound words? Well, you might think, you know, the monk might say, oh, wonderful, wonderful teaching. Thank you so much. Not quite. This is what Ummon said. If I had been there, I would have killed him with one blow and thrown his corpse into the maw of a hungry dog, thus to bring peace on earth. That's a strange thing to say. If I had been there, I would have thrown that smart-ass little baby into the mouth, the maw of a hungry dog. I would have killed him. Thus to bring peace on earth. That second part is very important. This isn't just anarchy. In a sense, it's anarchy, but it's religious anarchy. It's not just anarchy. Thus to bring peace on earth. You might say, again, you need to know the background, the context, what was happening at the end of the Tang Dynasty with the Dharma transmission, why he would say such a thing. But this is the way Yongmen is receiving Shakyamuni's transmission. Believe me, he is most respectful. He is much more respectful than the monk who says, oh, such wonderful words, I could never hope to equal them. Ummon is being most respectful, and he is really receiving the transmission. He's using traditional Zen terminology. It's pretty radical stuff. Let's go back one step further. How was Shakyamuni viewed in early Buddhism? Let's forget all this Zen stuff. What about in early Buddhism? How was Shakyamuni viewed? What did he say? We don't know one word with absolute historical certainty that the Shakyamuni spoke. It's generally agreed that there's a central corpus, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path, dependent co-origination, and whatnot. Probably he spoke about them. But historically speaking, we don't know for sure anything that he spoke. Okay? So this is religious tradition. But according to the earlier records of the Pali canon, of the Theravada tradition, not the Zen tradition, it says, Shakyamuni very strongly urged people to be a refuge to themselves. Rely on yourself, he said. Never rely on another. What could the transmission mean here? He's already saying you can't rely on another. What kind of a transmission is this? Also very interesting, he says, don't even rely on me. Don't accept what I say because I am a religious authority. You must take it and test it for yourself. And only when you know for yourself, then you should accept it. Don't even accept what I say unless you have tested it for yourself. That's in the Pali Canon, some of the earliest records of Shakyamuni. What kind of transmission is this? He also refused to lead the Buddhist Sangha or community. He said, I am not the leader of this community. The reason he said that was because one of his monks asked if he, Shakyamuni was about to die. So one of his leading monks asked, should I continue to lead? Should I take over for you? Should I get the Dharma transmission, perhaps? They didn't speak in that words, but what did Shakyamuni say? Yes, please, please, do what you can. No, he said, I have never considered myself the leader of this community. How can you assume to be the leader of a community? This community does not need a leader. Everyone is to find out the truth for themselves. One of my friends who's a Zen scholar, his name is McRae, he wrote the following. The role of the spiritual figurehead that Shakyamuni, the Buddha, specifically refused to fill was essentially identical to the role of the patriarch or Zen master in later Chinese Buddhism. Precisely what Shakyamuni refused to be is, in a sense, what the Zen master became. The Buddha's dying words, well known, were said to be, all things are subject to decay. All things break down. Nothing is permanent. Work out your own awakening with diligence. What kind of transmission is that? It sounds like the transmission of the untransmittable, perhaps, but it's a very different terminology. But it's a very interesting thing to say, and that was supposedly the dying words of Shakyamuni. All things are subject to decay, including me, including my words, including any transmission I might have. Work out your own salvation with diligence. You may know very basic Buddhism. They speak of, for example, all things are without permanence. Nothing lasts. All things are impermanent. Also, all things are without an ego self, a self-centered self. We think we have one, maybe, but if we thoroughly examine to the bottom, there is no such thing. It is precisely the attachment, the holding on to something as ego, that creates our suffering and our stress and our illusion and our greed and our desire. So this is very basic Buddhism. All things are without permanence, so there's nothing to grasp onto anyway, objectively speaking. Internally, all things are without ego, without self, without self-centered self. There is nothing you can say, this is me. There is no such thing. We'll come back to that later. Let me try to give an illustration to make this more concrete. We have a self or a subject, you or me, here. This self or this subject is trying to understand Buddhism. Not just understand it, but realize it, awaken to it. So what does he do? One possibility is to find something as an aid. Let's say a sutra, a book, a written text, a holy place. And he tries to identify with that. He tries to read it very carefully, enter into its meaning. And maybe he's able to do that to some extent. And to the extent that he can do that, it's as if he and the book, let's say, the words become one. The words become his own words. They're not simply words in a book. They become his deepest heart, self, or mind. And there can be a kind of a breakthrough with that to the bottom, so to speak. One of the great values of Zen Buddhism was that it said, let's stop going to the written words or the physical places. Let's go to another person, another subject, a self and another self. Preferably this one has already clearly realized the truth himself. Think of how much more you could get in contact that way, rather than simply reading about it, to be in direct human contact with someone who has realized this. That may not do everything, but it could certainly be a help. First of all, this is not unique to Zen Buddhism. If you study Indian religions, you will see that this has a very long ancient history, the guru tradition, way back before there ever was a Buddhism in the Hindu tradition. So this is not unique to Zen Buddhism. Sometimes the Zen masters make it sound like it is, but it's not. But it is very important. Rather than going to a text, going to another person. The problem here, and the way it's often explained, is you then think that through this contact with another person, there is the transmission, right? You have another person, and somehow, nanka, right? They talk about identifying the mind and the vessel from one to the other. But what I want to emphasize in this metaphor, it is just a metaphor, is that unless the person, the disciple, the student, himself lets go of his own ego, lets go of his own self, and in a sense plunges to the bottom, the transmission is not possible. Here, the transmission is not possible. The best he can do is scratch it or provide a kind of mirror reflection of what the person needs to be. And if you're in the presence of a master, you can sense that. This master is more me than I am myself. He's him, not me, but at his bottom, there's something there that is what I should be, and yet I'm not. So it can be very valuable. But it's not enough just to see or to gaze at that. You yourself have got to, in a sense, drop to the bottom. That's where the transmission really is. Only there is the transmission possible. Let me use a metaphor, a common Buddhist metaphor. They talk about the waves on the ocean and then the bottom, the bottomless depth of the ocean itself. What is a wave? A wave is the water. It's no different, right? Each wave is water, and the ocean itself is water. Okay? But what happens is, as an individual ego, ourselves, we take our own particular form, one particular wave. Maybe it's a very good one, or a very bad one, or joyous, whatever, or sad. And we attach to that form of the wave. What is it? Really, it is the water, but we identify it as this particular wave. What is the result? Well, we crash against other waves. If we really look, we realize we don't know where we came from, and we don't know where we're going. People ask, well, what's the problem? Well, if you're a wave, you know what the problem is. You don't know where you came from. You don't know where you're thrust about at the fate of things, and you're crashing into other things. That's suffering in Buddhism. That's samsara, life and death. That's not the answer. That's the problem, okay? To simply be a wave. The answer in Buddhism is not to stop being a wave and to be the ocean, but for the wave itself, you're a particular wave, I'm a particular wave. But we're also to realize at the depth that the wave itself is nothing but water. To realize that the wave itself is the entire ocean in this. You are the entire ocean in you. I am the entire ocean in myself. It's not to deny or to negate your individuality. Christians often misunderstand Buddhism that way. Buddhists sometimes express it that way, wrongly. I would say, rather, that is the fulfillment of your individuality. Because you are a wave, but you're only a wave, or you can only realize your true nature as the bottomless ocean itself. Then you are a wave, you are separate from the other person, and yet you are not separate. At bottom, you are none other than the other. The other is none other than you. Although you remain distinct, at bottom you are inseparable. This is a religious fact that anyone can attest to, can realize. And only there is the transmission possible. The transmission is not from one wave to the other wave. The transmission is any wave realizing itself as the bottomless ocean. And if you really want to know, then the transmission is without limit. A flower can transmit its truth to you then. A child can communicate its truth to you then. I'm not so interested in all of this narrow little Zen transmission stuff. I myself study in Japan. I study with a Zen master. I've gone through the koans and all that stuff. And it's very, very valuable. I'm not saying it's useless. It's very, very valuable. But we must realize that without ourselves letting go and becoming the ocean itself, the transmission up here is worthless, no matter how many transmission certificates you may get, or a Zen master, some other person telling you, yes, now you're enlightened. Without yourself having once gone to the bottom, transmission is impossible. That's what I would state. There is the true transmission. And then anything can transmit. There we're going beyond Buddhism, but I think it's about time we do that. I think this, we can speak not only about Zen or about Buddhism, but about the nature of religious experience here. We can meet on common ground, but that's beyond the limits of my lecture, because I want to go into this transmission and lineage. So let me try to answer some of the questions that I raised in the beginning. First of all, who transmits what? Transmission from another is not possible. Transmission from any other, including Shakyamuni himself, or the greatest Zen master you can meet, is not possible. As long as that other remains an other, you cannot get the transmission. Unless you yourself get to the bottom, transmission is not possible. Transmission from another is not possible. Transmission from yourself, in the ordinary sense of your ego, is also not possible. As a wave, you cannot do it. Transmission from another is not possible. Transmission merely from yourself, as long as you remain yourself, is not possible. Only when there is no self and no other is transmission possible. That's as simple and as clear as I can make it without using any Zen terminology. In fact, we can say no one transmits anything to anyone in Zen. If something is being transmitted, it is certainly not Zen. No one transmits anything to anyone in genuine Zen. There is room for real transmission. To put it very simply, and to return to the beginning of my lecture, who transmits what? This. The formless self, the heart, the mind, transmits what? Itself. To what? To itself. How? By itself. Why? For itself. Which is none other than, which contains everything else. That's why it can do that. To try to put some skin on the bones and to show you that I'm not making this up myself, I will give you some traditional Zen explanations which show the exact same thing. What better place to start than with Bodhidharma? He was said to be the beginning of Zen Buddhism in China. How did he transmit the Dharma? Very interesting story. This is also in the Mumonkan koan collection if you're interested. According to this, it's a very curious story, and I'll just give the essence. The man who becomes the second patriarch comes to meet Bodhidharma, the first Chinese patriarch. Bodhidharma is sitting in a cave. This is where supposedly Shorinji in Japanese, or Shaorinji in Chinese, this is where the martial arts supposedly started, but that's much later myth. Bodhidharma is sitting there facing the wall, and this troubled person, he goes on to become the second patriarch. He comes. Why? He has studied Buddhism.
the sutras. He has studied Confucianism. He has studied Taoism, the learning of the time in China. We're talking about 525 AD, so almost 1500 years ago. He, the man who goes on to become the second patriarch, studied all that, but he was not satisfied. He was still, his heart, the same character is used, is not at peace. So he comes to Bodhidharma and he says, this is to simplify the story, my mind, the same character, simply put, I am not at peace. Please help me, pacify me. Bodhidharma, the great teacher that he is, transmits the Dharma this way. He says, show me, bring forth this self that is not at peace, and I will pacify it. Supposedly, the second patriarch, it doesn't go into detail, this mind, and it is nowhere to be found. In other words, he realized, there is no self to seek. There is no self that suffers at bottom. But he had to realize that for himself. Bodhidharma didn't say, he didn't even say, let me show you how to sit Zazen, according to the records. This is Zen. And yet he said nothing about Zazen. He said nothing about a Dharma transmission. He said nothing about reading sutras. He said, bring it here, and I'll pacify it. Of course, there is nothing to pacify. He was saying that in order to help the second patriarch himself exhaust himself to find out there is no self to bring forth. There is no self that suffers. There is suffering. Don't deny that. You don't have to look very far. There is suffering. But there is no self that suffers. I am free from all suffering. This is the great Mahayana insight. Bodhidharma's answer was, there. Now your mind is at peace. This is the transmission in Zen Buddhism. Is there a transmission or not? What has been transmitted? Again, I repeat, this is the origin of the Zen tradition in China. There are many, many other examples I could give, but let me just give maybe one because it's a good one. This is by a guy named Sekito, or Shito in Chinese. He lived 700 to 790, early Chinese Zen master, a few hundred years after Bodhidharma. He talked about the mind, the same old character, the mind, the self itself being Buddha. Mind itself is Buddha. This is a famous expression later on, but he used it much earlier. And he said this so radically, right? He is a Buddhist master, and he's teaching these Buddhist monks, his disciples, who have gone through great learning, great practice, and now he's saying, your mind itself is the Buddha. Well, then what the hell do we do all that stuff for? Right? He was so radical. The mind itself is the Buddha. Well, he was speaking from the bottom of the ocean, and he is very correct when he says that. The mind itself is the Buddha. But the monks could not believe or fully accept that. So one of the monks had to ask, what about emancipation? Emancipation is the goal of Buddhism, right? We are bound by our own ego, so we need to be emancipated. He also asked about the Pure Land. Many of you may know the Pure Land is considered kind of a Buddhist heaven, okay? He also had to ask about Nirvana. Nirvana is the goal of Buddhism. It is in opposition to samsara, or the realm of life and death, the endless waves of suffering. How did the master respond to these questions? The master has just said, your mind itself is the Buddha. Then the monk says, but what about emancipation? What about the Pure Land? What about Nirvana? These are the great goals we are striving for. This is how he answered. What about emancipation? Who binds you? What about the Pure Land? Who defiles you? What about Nirvana? Who puts you in samsara?
He's speaking directly from the ocean itself, and he's absolutely right. It doesn't record whether the monk understood or not, but this master is not lying. What possible transmission could this be? What about nirvana? Who puts you in samsara? When have you ever been in samsara? If you look to the bottom of yourself. These are very challenging words. There are many other examples. Shall I speak about Rinzai? Or should I? Maybe just an example or two from Rinzai in Chinese, Linxi. This man is considered the founder, the father of the Rinzai Zen tradition. Although this is not in opposition to the Soto Zen tradition, because this was long before there was such an opposition. He lived also in the Tang Dynasty about 1100 years ago. Very curious story. He's studying very earnestly as a monk, it said, for 3 years, sitting Zazen very earnestly. And not once did he go to ask a master, the master, his teacher, Obaku in Japanese or Huang Po in Chinese. Not once did he go to ask the master anything. He simply did his practice. The head monk is very sharp himself. So he realizes this young monk, Rinzai, let me pronounce in Japanese, Rinzai, this man has potential. So he goes to Rinzai during one of the breaks and he says, "Have you ever been to talk to the master?" And Rinzai says, "No, I wouldn't know what to ask." And commentators have mentioned, this is not because he's stupid or he hasn't gone far enough. Really, it's because he's gone so far that he doesn't know what to ask. He's totally in the grips of his own doubt about what he is and what the Buddha is. He doesn't even know how to formulate a question. This is very profound. But the head monk wants to be helpful. So he says, "Rinzai, it doesn't matter what you ask in Zen as long as you ask it ultimately. Ask about the meaning of the Buddha Dharma, the Buddhist truth." This is a standard question to ask, like, "What is the Buddha?" Go ask, "What is the Buddha Dharma?" Well, Rinzai is a good monk, so he goes to the master and he says, he tries to say, "What is the Buddha Dharma?" Do any of you know the story? Well, before he even finishes asking the question, he gets hit. The master slaps him. So you can imagine, Rinzai goes in very seriously and he says, "Master, I beg to ask you what..." He bows again and he has to leave. The head monk is a little excited. This guy has potential. How did it go? "Well, I tried to ask him the question, but he hit me before I could even answer. I don't know where I have gone wrong." "Ask him again." "Okay." So he goes in again, and guess what happens? The same thing. A third, it says 3 times in Chinese, but that simply means many times. It could be 5, 10 times. But anyway, he went a number of times, and the same thing happened. He didn't even finish asking his question, and the master struck him. Rinzai decides, "Well, my karma is elsewhere. This is not my place. I can't even ask a question. I will go somewhere else." The head monk hears of this, and he goes to the master, and he says, "Master, this guy has potential. Please steer him in the right direction." So Rinzai has to go to the master to take his leave, to say that I'm leaving the monastery. The master says, "Don't go anywhere else but to Daiyu," in Chinese. Almost nothing is known about this guy, interestingly enough, not even the dates of his birth or death. "Don't go anywhere but to Daiyu's place." Rinzai's a good monk. Okay. So he goes and he finds this little hermitage of Daiyu. They don't even know where it is. They don't know anything about this guy. And Daiyu says, "What do you want?" And Rinzai explains, "I have been training for so many years, and I went to the master, and every time I asked him about the Buddhist truth, all he did was hit me. I don't know where I am at, where I was wrong." Daiyu, the great master that he is, says, "What? Your master treated you with grandmotherly kindness, and now you have the nerve to come here and ask me where you were wrong?" At that moment, Rinzai awakens. He breaks through the bottom of himself. And then he spontaneously responds, "Is that all there is to Huang Po's Buddha Dharma, to his master's Buddhist truth? That's it.
Not that there's nothing there, but that it was this right here all along. Is that all there is to the Buddha Dharma? The master, good master that he is, says, why, you little fool, you just came in here saying you don't know where you're wrong, and now you're saying there's not much to your master's Buddha Dharma. What have you seen? Speak, speak! Rinzai is not the person he used to be. He grabs the guy and pokes him in the ribs. The disciple to the master that he just met. The master realizes this is the real thing, so he lets him go. And what does he say?
You have the transmission?
No, he says, I have nothing to do with this. This is all your teacher, Huang Po's idea. Go back to him. He's a good master. So, a completely new Rinzai, same old Rinzai, but completely new, goes back to his master. Huang Po, the same old tough guy that he is, sees Rinzai. He doesn't realize yet what Rinzai has realized. So he says, you foolish fellow, coming and going, when will it all end? A completely new Rinzai says, no, master, it is all because of your kindness that I went to Dayu's place. And Rinzai tells what happened. Then Obaku, the master, says, why, referring to Dayu, the other master, if I had been there, I would have given him a good slap. Rinzai says, why wait? I'll do it right now. And he slaps this master. The attendant who's standing next to him, you can't believe what is going on. This young punk just comes back and he just struck the master. This is Chinese Tang Dynasty society. Huang Po, the master, is delighted because he sees that a real transmission has taken place, which is no transmission. So he says, take this wild guy to the head monk's position. But before he goes, he lets out a roar, which became famous as the ho of Rinzai, the ka in Japanese and Chinese, ho, this lion-like roar of the true self. It's an extraordinary story. But when finally Rinzai leaves Huang Po for good, his master, Huang Po says to his attendant, please bring the backrest and the armrest. This is actually of his master. Okay? Now it's Huang Po's, but he received it from his master. By the way, his master is the one that says, insight equaling the master's diminishes the master's by half. Only insight that surpasses the master's is equal of receiving the transmission. That guy. His armrest and a backrest are what older Zen masters used to use, not so much when they were sitting in Zazen, but when they would, you know, relax or write calligraphy or something. So what he is saying is, bring the proof of my transmission. Earlier days they used the robes or the bowls, different things, or sutras even. But now they're using the backrest and the armrest. So what is the master saying? He's saying, I am now transmitting my dharma to Rinzai. He is now the man. I'm giving him the symbols of the transmission. What would you do in such an instance? Do you know what Rinzai said? Because he received the true transmission. The master said, attendant, bring the armrest and the backrest of my late master. I wish to give them to Rinzai. Rinzai immediately said, attendant, bring some fire. I'm going to burn. I don't need such things. Interestingly enough, the master then said, that may be so, but take them with you anyway. Later on, you will cut off the tongues of all beings on earth. So again, we're back at the beginning. You don't need it, and yet the master is making sure he has some kind of a symbol of it. But he didn't give him, well, he gave him a backrest and an armrest, but don't think that that's the transmission. What Rinzai came to when he was actually with the other master, that was the transmission. And he transmitted it from his own true self. Huang Po, his master, had a very important role to help to authenticate that and to test it and to make sure that it was real. But he didn't give anything to Rinzai. He didn't transmit. Transmission is a holy lie in Buddhism. If you go through the Zen training, you will see It is very, very valuable. It's also a holy lie. There is no such thing. When you finally realize that, you have the transmission. I think this is a stunning example of it. Again, remember, he said, bring me fire. In other words, I have no need of such things. I'm going to burn them. I'm going to bring those things. It's more luggage anyway, right? I'm traveling all over the world, so I know what having luggage means. It can really be a pain in the butt. Bring me a fire. But again, it's also important that his master said, be that as it may, that's true. You're right. You're speaking from the truth. And yet, take them with you anyway. So again, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying the more formal transmission of a master to a disciple is not important. It's extremely important. But it's only of any value at all based on your own breakthrough, your own awakening. That's enough. I think it's going a little bit long here. There are many other things I could say, but let me just talk a little bit about why lineage and transmission developed in the first place. If it is a holy lie, as I just said, where did it come from? Well, it's not a very pleasant story, but recently scholars have gone into this and have been able to study and ask, where did this come from? It's important for us in Europe because we so, not only Europe, I'm an American, in America too, and in Japan as well, there's this blind obedience to this very literal, very formal kind of Dharma transmission. But if you really see where it came from and why it developed, you'll realize how utterly absurd it is to continue it the way that it is in Europe. It has no place here. It doesn't even have any place in Japan anymore. Where did it develop? About 1,400 years ago in China, when Buddhism was finally finding a home in China, there was a need for the various schools and traditions to show that they were authentic. And this had a great deal of importance. If they could show that to the emperor, they could get imperial honors. They could have all kinds of power. They could have monasteries built. They could receive the purple robe. It was very important. It was a social, political thing. But it had to be done. If they didn't do it, perhaps their own line, their own lineage might die out. The Tendai, or in Chinese, Tiantai, tradition of Buddhism actually was concerned with this before Zen was. But what they did was they created, it's not history, they created a lineage of people from Shakyamuni, right? When this person transmitted the truth, then this person transmitted the truth. They actually had at one point six people for a period of 1,000 years because the guy didn't do his homework. These guys didn't live that long. I mean, some of them, they say, Joshu lived to 120. But, I mean, they just didn't get their math right. So what they did was they made it 28 instead of 6 because they just didn't make it with 6. But they created. Some of them are historical figures, Nagarjuna, probably Shakyamuni, Mahakashapa, on for some generation. But there are gaps where there is no one. So they put somebody in there. They made somebody up. That's all. No more, no less. It's not history. Okay? And now, in the mornings, when we chant this whole line, Mahaka, it's not history, it's religious history, but it's not history. Okay? They made it up, and they made it up for a very specific reason. Why? Because the other schools were introducing Buddhist sutras, and they were saying, here is my authority. There's great respect for this, for example, the Lotus Sutra, and we take, as our tradition, this sutra. The emperor can understand that. Yes, fine. You can build monasteries. You can ordain monks. You can have this amount of land. What is the Zen school going to do? Well, these are, in some sense, a group of meditating monks. There is no Zen school in early Tang Dynasty. We look back at it, but there really was none. They didn't call themselves Zen monks. This is much later. But they had to protect themselves. So one in particular, if you want to know, one generation after the sixth patriarch, the man that was called the seventh patriarch, he's now largely lost to history, is the one that basically created this myth. And he created it and stressed it because what he wanted to say, as I mentioned briefly before, was that what our transmission is actually from the Buddha himself. It's not through written words. It's not through a sutra. It's the mind itself. Okay? And it came to be taken rather literally in the sense that it's kind of ESP kind of stuff over, you know, the first quotes that I gave you. They can be misunderstood that way. It's a holy lie. Well, I don't think we need to go into any more technical points. It's a rather complex scholarly subject. But what are the problems that result from taking this lineage and transmission too seriously or too literally? I think there are enormous problems. First among them is a sectarianism that naturally will develop, because you have one school in one line with one lineage, and then you have maybe another school, another lineage here. Well, which one is true? Well, mine is, of course, right? Everyone will want to say their own lineages too, if they take it that way, right? I look at it this way. You know the Tower of Babel in the Old Testament? Supposedly people wanted to build the tower to go and to encounter God. When God saw this and realized the vanity of it, he crushed it, and then it said the division into languages, tongues. People could not communicate, and that's why we have different languages in the world today. Well, I suppose this is a kind of religious myth too, but it's a very profound one. The Tower of Babel. I look at it this as kind of the tunnel of Buddha. People look at it as we achieve the Buddhist truth through this Buddhist tunnel back 2,500 years from Shakyamuni. That's nonsense. That's nonsense. That's just as vain as the Tower of Babel to try to do it that way. They're missing one very important thing: where the transmission really must come from. But there are many other problems. I'll just briefly mention them, and if there's interest during the discussion, we can talk about it. For example, Buddhism in China degenerated basically into a kind of ancestor worship and funeral Buddhism, what's still called in Japan today. The average Japanese in Japan thinks of Buddhism as little more than funeral Buddhism. It's a place to go for funeral services or for memorial services. They don't go to do zazen like we do. Okay? What does that have to do with lineage and transmission? It's very much connected, because in order for them to get the power, they had to, I'll read it rather than just try to say it. Buddhist monks became priests for the ancestral cults of their patrons, and of course for the emperor as well. That was a very great honor. Temples were established in order to pray for the good fortune of the deceased members of the donor family, the people who gave the money or the land. Temples became a substitute for ancestral temples and what became in Japanese cemetery or funeral temples. That's largely what Buddhism is today, like it or not. And it is very much connected with the lineage, and it goes back almost 1,400 years, and we still blindly follow it. Temples were also erected to protect the state, and this also had to do with the importance of the lineage and the transmission, and who was going to have that very important state temple, both in China and in Japan. There are many other, even more bizarre examples. Formal transmission in Soto Zen became completely unrelated to any kind of religious awakening. They had to have priests for every temple in order for that temple to continue the lineage. In Soto Zen, the lineage is connected with the temple. So it actually got to the point in Japan where the priests got together and basically said, it doesn't matter whether the priest has any awakening or not. We have 14,000 temples that we need priests for. So let's just put them in. There was, of course, a big disagreement about it, but they finally came up with the bizarre idea that what we do is we allow the person to get literally the Dharma transmission, whether they have any insight or not. And that continues to today. It's largely a formal thing in Soto Zen. I don't want to be unfair. There are similar problems in Rinzai Zen as well, and I myself practice in a Rinzai monastery, so I don't want to say, but. Or otherwise, I'm just doing the same sectarian division that I'm criticizing. Rinzai Zen has almost exactly the same problem. If you look, for example, in history, what's called the purple robe incident, the idea of getting the purple robe from the emperor, there was a tremendous fight among the different Rinzai Zen monastery complexes in Japan. And it was a very ugly thing. The emperor had to abdicate, and Takuan, the pickled vegetable Takuan is named after this Zen monk, he was basically thrown out of the land. It was a very bizarre story. So all I want to say is not only in Soto, but in Rinzai Zen as well, the importance of lineage gradually created tremendous problems and tensions and contradictions, and basically it comes down to a kind of sectarianism and a need to preserve that. And I think the less we have of that in Europe or in America or in Japan, the better. I don't think we have much success in Japan at this point, but at least in Europe, I think we can fare better. There are many sectarian rivalries in Zen Buddhism. It's strange. For example, north and south, or the sudden and the gradual, or Kana, Koan Zen, and Soto, Shikantaza, just sitting Zen. We now look at them in very clear black and white terms, and usually, depending on which side we're on, one is good and one is bad or false. But if you go back and you study the history, you see it wasn't like that at all. Just to give a simple example, the sixth patriarch became the sixth patriarch because he emphasized immediate awakening, right? If you look at the waves in the ocean, you can't gradually go down. It's got to be an immediate, unmediated awakening. Unmediated also means there can't be a master to do it, finally. It's immediate. It has to be. It can't be gradual. The process, the practice itself, of course, is gradual. But the awakening, the realization itself, must be immediate. Usually they say sudden. That's wrong. Sudden means quickness in time. It's immediate. It's beyond time and place. You break through time and place. Okay? But if you actually go back and look at the teachings of the sixth patriarch, they're almost the same as the gradual teachings. Only after time, especially the man that became the seventh patriarch, he rewrote the history. And he made all of these vicious claims against the northern school, the gradual school, and he rewrote what the sixth patriarch said so that it looked very black and white. It's not that easy. So we have to be very careful of this kind of sectarianism, not only when we deal with another religion, but perhaps more importantly, when we deal within that religion. Oh, he's Soto. He studies with such and such a person, that kind of lineage. That's all secondary, isn't it? I think you can see that. Before I end, I'd like to just bring one more point, and this isn't new. If you go back to early Buddhism, you can see the same kind of sectarianism that broke up Buddhism and created the many different schools that we have today. And sometimes it's a very ugly thing. For example, do you know what the first basic schism or disagreement in Buddhism supposedly is, according to history? There were 5 points that one group of monks argued for and another group of monks argued against. Finally, they broke up, they created separate sanghas or communities. And this is much more complicated than Theravada and Mahayana, but eventually these schools tended to become Theravada. These schools tended to become what's called Mahayana, of which Zen is a school. Does anyone know what the first big disagreement that created a schism in Buddhism was? Does anybody know? The first point was whether an enlightened person has wet dreams or not. I'm serious. A monk who supposedly had attained what they call arhatship, he was enlightened. This was after the death of the Buddha, about 100 years, so they couldn't go to the Buddha and say, okay, now you can decide. He had passed away about 100 years before. A master, supposedly, had a wet dream. How do we know? Well, his attendants, who were studying under him, went to clean his robes in the morning and they saw a stain. Everyone knows what a wet dream is. I guess the Dutch are pretty comfortable with this stuff. At least as comfortable as the Americans. Okay? And they noticed a stain. And so the monk had a doubt. He said, but he is supposed to be an enlightened one. And I'm studying with him. How could he still have sexual desire? So he went and he talked to the master. And basically, according to the story, the master said, wait a minute. What is a wet dream? It's no different than sweat or tears. It is a natural emission. If I had the wet dream with desire and attachment, then I would not be a Buddha. But I have the wet dream without attachment, so therefore it's okay. Well, not everybody agreed with that. There was a big disagreement. But wait a minute. Think about it. You all laugh, but it's a pretty basic question that I think some, most, all of us have. If you get enlightened, what exactly is the connection with your sexual nature? Does it disappear? Do you become androgynous? Do your sexual organs fall off? No. No. I mean, there are supposedly enlightened married people. What do they do? I think this is a very good question. What is the nature of sexual desire for an enlightened person? That was the first question that they had an argument about. And you know what? It sounds like a pretty good one today. It sounds like one that each one of us has to wrestle with, I think. There are other questions too. For example, the second one was ignorance. The monk, the same monk, found out that the same master did not know something. This is funny. You're supposed to be enlightened. You're supposed to know everything. The master, again, very adeptly. No, I know everything about the nature of enlightenment. But that doesn't mean I know what he's thinking or what the weather's going to be tomorrow. I only know the nature of things, but not in their specifics. Some people agree, some people didn't. But isn't this a good question? Do you still have ignorance if you're enlightened? And if so, what kind of ignorance do you have? If you think you don't have any ignorance, maybe that could be a great danger. I think it's a very good question for every one of us to have. Another question was, the third one was doubt. He saw the master in a state of doubt. He said, but master, now you look like you're doubtful. You're supposed to be enlightened. Master, okay, well, I am enlightened. About my true nature, I have no doubt. But about other things, I do have doubt. Some people agreed, some people didn't. But I think this is a very good question, too. There is a moment when you may have no doubt whatsoever. But we face the world in many different ways. And simply to assume that there is no doubt, sounds like a pretty good question for all of us to wrestle with. The fourth one is interesting. The fourth one is whether you can awaken through another. Because the master said, you have to continue following me to get enlightened. And the monk said, but what about this being a refuge to yourself? The master said, well, yeah, you can get enlightened on your own, but you may need a master to clarify what you already know but may not be aware of, which is kind of the beginning of this whole question, isn't it? What is the transmission? That question was already back there 100 years after the death of Buddha. The fifth question has to do with whether someone shouts out when he gets enlightenment, but that's also perhaps a very relevant question for Zen Buddhism. But again, these five questions, whether there is sexual desire, whether an enlightened being can have wet dreams, ignorance, doubt, awaken through another, or whether he cries out when awakened. These were the first five questions that created a huge schism, a division in Buddhism. But do you know what happened? If you go back and you study the literature, what happened is a very good monk raised these questions, and he's the one that said, no, it's okay. And this is gradually what became Mahayana Buddhism. For those of you who are Zen or Tendai or Pure Land or any other, by the way, you're with a group that says it's okay to have wet dreams, okay? Any of you who are Theravada Buddhists, by the way, say, no, you can't have wet dreams. You can't have any ignorance. You can't have any doubt. Okay? Needless to say, it's not as simple as that. Okay? It was a much more complex and a very good issue, I think, a very good question. But this is what happened. If you look at the Theravada tradition, this is how the history came down. A very good monk raise these questions. About 150 or 200 years later, this is the story. The man who was to become that monk slept with his mother. Okay, there's no record of that earlier. This is created later by one side, okay? They want to make clear who's good and who's bad, okay? What did this guy do? When he was a child, he slept with his mother. Sounds pretty bad. I mean, he doesn't sound like such a nice guy. Then what did he do? He got jealous of his father, and he killed his father, Cardinal Sin. Pretty bad stuff, huh? Then he ran away with his own mother to a foreign land, but it turned out that a monk, a Buddhist monk from his community, happened to be there. And this person saw, this person's name is Mahadeva in the literature. He saw this monk and he thought, he may recognize me. So he killed the monk. Another cardinal sin. Is it clear to us now whether he's good or bad, in case you had any doubt? There's no literature that says he did any of that when you go further back. But in the developed Theravada tradition, it says he slept with his mother, killed his father, then he killed the monk. Then he started to feel guilty and he himself became a monk. But because he wasn't genuine, he had wet dreams, he had desire, right? Are we pretty clear on whether he's the real thing or not? According to that school. But this is just another example in very early Buddhism of what happens when you have legitimate questions that are kind of swept under the rug, and instead you replace them with these very narrow lineages which have to defend themselves. Okay? So I'm not interested in defending Rinzai Zen, let alone Zen, really, let alone Buddhism. Finally, what I'd like to say is I think to find the bottom of the ocean yourself, to awaken to your true self in Zen terms, is something that is not limited to Buddhism. I think it has something to do with humankind. I would like to look at it that way. I'm not interested in being a Buddhist or being a Christian or anything like that. It doesn't matter to me. I would say the depth of our humanity is found here. Okay? So I'm not interested in propagating Buddhism. And I think what it is awakening to is what is really real. It is nothing other than reality. It is not a myth that we are all one at bottom. That is a fact which you have to attest to, and you can. That is true. That is a religious truth. And when it comes down to it, I don't think it is limited to Buddhism. I would like to say all religions, in some sense, can join in that. Or even forget religion. Even if you're an atheist, if you're willing to get to the bottom of yourself, all humankind ground is grounded in this. It is the ground of humanity. Why call it a transmission in some lineage? I find it rather silly myself. Although, if someone wishes to study Rinzai Zen, as I myself am doing it, I find it extremely valuable, but I hope you don't get caught in it. Well, this is a long talk. Shall we end here so we have some time for discussion?